Welcome to Tech Nation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies and breakthrough science. Today, our chief correspondent, Dr. Daniel Kraft, speaks to the idea of science marches on, how new science can change the practice of medicine. The topic is diet. Then, while lithium is the prescribed treatment for bipolar disorder, we didn't know why it worked. Dr. Evan Snyder joins me from the Sanford Burnham Prebys Medical Discovery Institute. They figured out why lithium works, and he'll tell us why that's important. Now back to the subject of what science has learned and diet. Dr. Daniel Kraft is our chief correspondent.
Often the science advances, but often health and medicine and certainly diet fads don't. You go into any bookstore, there's 100 different diets saying this is the magic approach for you to lose weight and keep it off. But we're learning that we're all individual. We have different ethnicities, i.e. and genetics that relate to that. Certain ethnic groups have different sort of body habituses and respond differently to diet. We know how we have different microbiomes, the bugs, whether the bacteria and viruses in our bodies, on our bodies, in our gut, seem to play a very critical role in metabolism. Those might impact what diet might work for you if you're trying to lose weight or optimize health. We're now looking at the realm of all the omics, from proteomics and beyond. So as science advances and we now have exponentially less expensive full genomes, we're even at the point of doing your own self-microbiome. Companies like Ubiome or Second Genome can enable you to sequence your gut and your skin flora and use that potentially to inform what diet you might be on to optimize weight loss or optimize for running a marathon. One example of where microbiome meets medicine that most folks might recall are ulcers. You know, the old way of treating an ulcer, you know, pain in your stomach that often was formed from a little ulceration, was to treat it surgically, cut it out. Over 20, 30 years ago, we learned that it wasn't from just stress that people were having ulcers. It was the microbiome in the gut, H. pylori. Helicobacter pylori was responsible for kind of festering in that ulcer and causing the symptoms. So we now treat that with basically antibiotics.
They were saying you have to drink milk and you can't be eating spicy food. But it wasn't any of that.
It's an example of something that took a long time to be actually discovered. The gentleman who discovered it drank H. pylori and gave him his own ulcer. He actually won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for this. And it took over 17 years from that being published and being, you know, knowledge that was presented in medical conferences becoming standard of care. So one challenge we have across health and medicine is we're in this age of increasing data and publications, but how do we make sense of it? How do we translate that to the patient, to the clinic, to actionable, useful information? Because the average physician in the United States, remember 50% of doctors are below average, read journals, you know, the usual way to keep up, maybe only 3 or 4 hours a month. There's no way to keep up with the latest ulcer therapy, let alone the best way to treat this diet for diabetic. So we're going to see the need to integrate what I like to call not artificial intelligence but intelligence augmentation, to integrate this, to present it to the patient, the nutritionist, the physician at the point of care. One example, we have a huge scourge of obesity, a lot of type 2 diabetics. You know, type 2 diabetes is a broad label for folks who have insulin insensitivity. Some need insulin. We have to modify their diets, et cetera. But it's not one size fits all. There's been work out of Mount Sinai in New York where they looked at the genomes of several thousand type 2 diabetics and applied machine learning and AI and found that there were at least 3 very distinct subtypes of type 2 diabetics who responded differently to diet and exercise. And I think we'll see that happen across many diseases. So the future of where science, you know, meets medicine in terms of moving on will be to apply lots of this new data, make it actionable information, and tune the therapy, whether that's a diet, a device, an app, to meet that individual where they are for prevention, diagnostics, or therapy.
I have to say, part of the reason I think people reject diet as part of the solution to their medical wellness, if you will, is that there are all these diets out there because you want to lose weight, as you say, many of whom either work for a short time or don't work at all, and there's no magic bullet here. But then when it comes to a health condition that you have, you might not be in the group that the diet that's been recommended to you will respond to. Right. And then you abandon the diet pretty soon on. You say, well, is it the diet or not? I mean, this has sort of given diet a bad name.
It has. There's a lot of yo-yo diet. Part of it is the psychology. How do you
keep
someone
engaged?
I think
we've got it. Well, we'll publish the yo-yo diet. We'll be right.
Well, where this is headed, it will be that we'll have the Daniel diet or the Moira diet that will be based on taking your genome, your microbiome, maybe sequentially from your nose, your gut, and beyond. We'll be looking at your base genomics and testing you, giving you a sugar drink or protein drink, and looking at your blood sugars as you respond. There are actually companies doing that now. A new company recently launched called Viome that's looking to modify an optimized diet. A company called Aravail and Human Longevity Incorporated integrate lots of data. There's one called Nutrino here in San Francisco. We're starting to connect the dots between big data meets actionable information and giving you a personalized diet. And there are even startups now that, based on information, will deliver you, you know, three meals a day to match your omics. And we're going to learn over time, these aren't perfect, how to continually tune that to the individual so that the future of diet taking is not one-size-fits-all fad, but personalized, precise, and effective.
And to be clear, science is really studying diet on many, many, many levels. We can expect new things to come out constantly.
Right. It's not going to be just about the calories. It won't be just about more pasta or less fat. It may be something that changes dynamically with age, with different diseases, and particularly in diseases like prediabetes or diabetes. We're seeing companies both work on the therapeutics of truly optimizing the diet to reverse diabetes or prevent it in the first place. And if you know your omics and your risk for certain elements, for example, Indian men are at high risk of type 2 diabetes. If we're proactive, if we move from this era of reactive sick care and get them folks while they're young and relatively healthy, with food as the most important drug we take every day, we can cut trillions off our healthcare costs and cut suffering around the planet. While microbiome certainly plays a role potentially in our ability to metabolize our calories, and we can learn that in some cases, microbiome transplants and reboots really may help folks lose weight. We know that we're seeing in some hospital settings the idea of doing a fecal transplant. Folks who have a overinfection of a certain microbe, often called C. difficile, several thousand people die in the United States every year from this bad infection, usually in intensive care units, that often doesn't respond to antibiotics. We're now rebooting their GI system with a fecal transplant using from a friend or relative. Part of the future of treating GI infections may be these sort of fecal transplants that are now drugified. Or if you have a particular issue with obesity or inflammatory bowel disease, which seems to be tied to microbiome, you may reboot your microbiome or tune its environment with different drugs and probiotics. So we're starting to learn a lot. There's folks who often get their microbiome done every week. And as we can crowdsource more of this information, we'll learn how to use it to prevent obesity, treat Crohn's disease, inflammatory bowel disease, maybe understand the microbiome's role in some psychiatric disorders and Parkinson's. So we're really starting to see the science hopefully meet the healthcare. There's lots of regulatory reimbursement and other uncertainties, but it's a time that we can use omics, microbiome, and beyond, not just to affect our daily diets, but to proactively prevent and treat certain diseases.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much.
Thanks, Myra.
Dr. Daniel Kraft is chief correspondent of TechNation Health and the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. The prescribed treatment for bipolar disorder is lithium, and that's been the prescribed treatment for decades. Still, it only works for about one-third of the patients. Dr. Evan Snyder is a professor and the director of the Center for Stem Cells and Regenerative Medicine at Sanford Burnham Prebys Medical Discovery Institute.
Lithium has been around for more than decades, for scores of years, but nobody ever knew why it worked, except it does work and is very, very effective for about a third of patients with bipolar disease.
You actually did an amount of research that discovered why it worked.
Well, what was intriguing is that, as often happens in medicine, drugs are used because they're effective, but one doesn't really know why they work. For example, we used aspirin for centuries before knowing anything about why it worked. Now, what we reasoned, however, is that what also is not known is what causes psychiatric disorders, and in particular, bipolar disorder. But we reason that lithium gave bipolar disease a unique advantage in our hands. If we could figure out why it worked, if we could figure out its target, then that would give us insight, we thought, into what causes bipolar disease. And then, of course, once you know the cause, then you can find even better drugs. Because even though lithium is effective, it is not an ideal drug. And anybody who has been on lithium or knows somebody on lithium can attest to that. There's many, many off-target side effects that sometimes make patients who need the drug stop taking it. It has a very narrow safety index, so it's a very dangerous drug if you don't monitor it. And it has all kinds of other activities. So if you could find a better drug that was very precise, that would be a great boon. And to do that, you need to know what causes the disease. So in a way, the way most people do drug discovery is they know the mechanism, they know what causes the disease, and then they do a search for a drug that hits that particular mechanism. Well, this was the reverse. In fact, it may even be the first time we did a reverse drug discovery strategy. We had a drug that worked, and we used that to find the mechanism. Now, of course, once we know the mechanism, then we can have biomarkers, and we can have diagnostics and prognostics, and we can follow how a patient responds. But more importantly, we can find better drugs. It's even intriguing, and we can talk more about this, that the cause of bipolar is a very fundamental developmental and biologic process, that the drugs that work for this disease and this disorder may actually work for other disorders, not just psychiatric disorders, but maybe other neurologic disorders as well.
Now, we only have 35%, a third of the people who are diagnosed with bipolar responding to lithium. What about the other two-thirds?
Well, the fact that only a third of the patients responded was intriguing to us. Now, there's a few ways of looking at that. It could simply be, well, there's a quantitative difference between those populations. Maybe if we used more lithium or a more frequent at a higher dose, then they would respond. Another possibility is that there's a real qualitative difference, and that the patients who have an abnormality in what we call the lithium response pathway are one disease, and the other two-thirds of patients have an entirely different disease.
They aren't bipolar?
They have the symptoms of bipolar, and we diagnose them as bipolar based on how they act, but the cause of their behavioral problems is not the same fundamental molecular mechanism. They have a different. And even that two-thirds may have different subpopulations that have different causes.
It's like you and I both blow our nose. I have an allergy and you have a common cold.
that's very interesting.
Two different things, same kind of observed.
Exactly,
difference.
Exactly. And, you know, this type of thing happens in medicine a lot. We look at patients and we give them a diagnosis based on how they appear. Now, and that's the history of medicine for 100 years.
That's all we could do anyway.
Exactly. And then as you start understanding what causes the disease, then all of a sudden, instead of lumping them, you start splitting them. And diabetes, for example, is a very great example of this. Everybody who had a problem with regulating their sugar was called a diabetic. And then it became interesting that some patients presented when they were kids, and that was called juvenile onset, and some didn't present until they were older and adults, and that was called adult onset. And then we started realizing that they were caused by two separate mechanisms. The kids had an autoimmune problem. The adults had a problem in being able to respond to insulin, a receptor problem. Now, we still call them diabetes because they have a sugar regulation problem, but we use different drugs at some level, or at least we look for different causes and different etiologies. I think it's going to be the same thing with psychiatric disorders, and I think what we have found in bipolar disease will be the very first example of that.
What was it about the lithium that worked?
So what we decided to do was not look at gene differences.
It worked for too many people.
Well, investigators have been looking for a gene that can cause many psychiatric disorders, but including bipolar, for 15 years, and that just hasn't helped us much. So we decided to go to the next higher level, which is actually looking at the protein. Proteins are what genes make. They kind of integrate all the signals from the genes and from the environment, and they ultimately determine what the cell is going to do. So we took neurons, and we did some tricks to be able to get neurons, nerve cells, kind of the business cell of the brain, from patients with bipolar disease that we knew responded to lithium, and compared them with neurons from patients that do not respond to lithium, and look to see what lithium changed in one nerve cell but not in the other. And that's what we called lithium's target. So what we did then is kind of mapping. And in science, it's called mapping. Imagine that you want to know your way around a city. If somebody gives you the intersection where you need to be, you can then figure out, well, here's where I go if I go north, and here's what happens if I go south, and, oh, this is Main Street, and here's where the stores are. Well, we did the exact same thing scientifically. We first found, kind of like putting a GPS pin on your app, we found where lithium works, and then once we had that, lithium's target, we could map upstream and downstream, and we found that what it altered was a fundamental pathway that makes nerve cells figure out what kind of connections they should make and how strong those connections should be and how they should act in response to various stressors and environmental changes. Well, this was kind of cool because it took a very complex behavior and reduced it to very concrete manifestations of what we as neurobiologists know, how do nerves make their connections.
The only thing I find really scary about this is how did you get those people's neurons out of their brains?
Well, that...
And by the way, I'm not volunteering for anything that you do, Evan, just so you know.
Well, you know, in the early, early days of the stem cell field, we figured that once we figured out that there were stem cells in the brain, that very quickly we could start understanding diseases. And it's true. In the old days, we used to have to rely on getting material from post-mortem specimens, from an autopsy specimen or from a miscarriage or things like that. And as you alluded to, so few people were willing while they were alive to volunteer their nerve cells. But about 10 years ago, there was a technique developed which indicated that from very accessible tissue, from skin, from blood, you could take those cells, even though they weren't mature, even though they weren't nerve cells, and through some molecular tricks, turn them back into stem cells. It's kind of like backing off the off-ramp and putting them back on the highway to be stem cells again and then turn them into nerve cells. And that's what we were looking at. We were looking at stem cells that gave rise to neurons or nerve cells that came from patients' skin or blood. So very accessible, but what that allowed us to do was look at many, many patients, huge number of patients, and even some of their relatives, and nerve cells from patients with all different kinds of diseases and on all different kinds of drugs. So that helped us validate our findings. And then, of course, that's not enough because those are cells in a dish. You have to validate it in some animal models, and our hypothesis stood up. And then what we actually did is we went to actual brain specimens in a brain bank of real patients who had had bipolar disease and were on lithium or not on lithium. And what we found is that this same marker in the actual patients with bipolar were abnormal. And what lithium does is it's abnormal, but it's kind of a set point. Think of it as a thermostat that needs to be regulated for the nerve cells to be able to respond to environments. And all of us have it, But the patients with bipolar disease, their set point is just a little abnormal, and lithium re-regulates the thermostat, the set point. Well, what we found in a dish and what we found in the animals with regard to this was validated in actual patient brains. Their set point was abnormal, and their neural connections, or at least what looked like would be responsible for neural connections, was abnormal. But lithium normalized both of those.
Lithium is a metal, isn't it?
And it is. I have a grad student who said that one of the smallest elements known to man is responsible for changing one of the most complex behaviors known to man, which is the behavior of the nervous system.
Evan, Dr. Snyder, thank you so much for coming in. I hope you'll come back and see us again.
This was wonderful. Thanks so much for asking.
Dr. Evan Snyder is a professor and the director of the Center for Stem Cells and Regenerative Medicine at Sanford Burnham Prebys Medical Discovery Institute. More information is available at sbpdiscovery.org. For Tech Nation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Muller, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.